Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the first day of February. We're going to be talking about what's going on in Egypt and in other countries in the Mideast this hour of our program. One of our guests this hour, Diane Singerman, writes, the regime in Egypt has not delivered on equitable economic growth. It has not delivered on the peace process, and it has impoverished and marginalized the young and frustrated their dreams and hopes. Young people, whether part of the blogosphere, leftist, Nazarist, feminist, or Islamist movements, have been seared by their experience and exposure to state repression, intimidation, and humiliation. Is a regime change likely? When might it happen? What would be the new form of a new government in Egypt? And we'll be talking about the U.S. response to all that's been going on in Egypt since last week, the first hour of our program today. And welcoming your phone calls and your messages, and we'll give you those numbers momentarily. We have two guests with us. Diane Singerman is Associate Professor, Department of Government in the School of Public Affairs and co-director of the Middle East Studies at American University, author of Cairo Contested, Governance, Urban Space, and Global Modernity. And she studied, actually, in Egypt, too, and She is teaching comparative politics, Middle East and Egyptian politics, gender and politics in the Middle East, and she is one of our guests this hour. Thank you very much, Professor Singerman, for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Hello.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
And thank you very much for being with us. Also joining us this hour, for most of the hour, is Professor Vicki Langhorre. She's Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at the College of the Holy Cross. Professor Langhorre, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Vicki. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
All right, you're friends.
Yes, we are.
Good, great. Well, let's talk about how imminent regime change is in Egypt. The protests keep getting larger, and it seems inevitable. Is it inevitable that Mubarak is going to be gone?
Diane, you want to go first?
Sure. It seems that that is the case. Yet, at the same time, it's very clear that the president is using all of his capabilities to stay in power. So on the one hand, it seems inevitable, but this president has been in power for a very long time. He has powerful supporters, and he seems willing to use both his control of communications, financial resources, the military, the police. So it seems inevitable, but I'm not sure that is exactly going to transpire. I hope it does, but at the same time, he still might have some tricks up his sleeve.
Do you agree, Vicki?
I do, but I think there are two signs that I think make me very hopeful, and I'd be interested to hear what Diane thinks. I mean, the fact that the army came out yesterday and said not only that they wouldn't shoot, which is often the beginning of the end for regimes when the army won't shoot, but also that they thought the protesters had legitimate demands, and of course the main demand is for Mubarak to step down, suggested to me that the army may either not be receiving orders from Mubarak to resist or may not intend to actually follow those orders if they're given. And I just read this morning on BBC, I just got into the office, that the American ambassador has contacted Mohammed al-Baradei, which maybe they've been in contact before, but the fact that that's being made public I think is also a good sign that while I would have liked the United States to come out more clearly and say the Mubarak regime really can't meet the demands of the protesters, I think the fact that they're openly now signaling that we're in contact with the presumed caretaker government after Mubarak would step down is sending a good signal.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that Mubarak has been the head of Egypt, the strongman man of Egypt, some would say, for 30 years now? Why him? Why that kind of length of power?
Diane?
I think that a couple of things are going on. If you remember, President Mubarak was Anwar Sadat's vice president, and so he took over in a moment of crisis. He was the legitimate successor, and he continued to build both an economic policy and a kind of a political apparatus. He strengthened the National Democratic Party, which is the largest party in Egypt, the sort of one-party state. And basically, through legal mechanisms, through all kinds of mechanisms, he's hollowed out civil society. He's tried to repress and fragment the Islamist movement. And he has tremendous resources at his disposal, including U.S. foreign, economic, and military aid. So he's managed to contain any kind of alternative and deploy all kinds of forces, including military law, which suspends civil and political rights. So it's been very difficult to organize. It's been very difficult to foster collective life in Egypt. But at the same time, there have been strong popular movements. There have been many labor protests in the labor movement. The Muslim Brotherhood and other groups have been strong. So despite all of these constraints, people keep organizing. Yet it's extremely difficult to overcome, to sort of publicly fight the regime, because people are arrested, harassed, tortured, killed, etc.
Is there a concern that the Muslim Brotherhood is behind the protests and that Egypt could have an Islamist government, which would be of concern to the United States?
The Muslim Brotherhood is clearly a participant in the demonstrations, but behind would give the sense, when you said, are they behind the demonstrations, mm-hmm. that kind of gives the sense that they orchestrated them and are the main force, and I think that's clearly not the case. They were, I think, caught off guard as much as anybody else by how quickly this spiraled, and they certainly over the days have taken a bigger and bigger role, but in any post-Mubarak democratic future with free elections, they will take a significant role in the government because they are popular. Whether that's a majority role, I think, is very much in question. There are also these other political parties and political figures. And I think one of the benefits of the last 2 weeks or so has been that the folks, especially youth, who were instrumental in the very beginnings of these protests, will have to have some role in that government as well. So I think these protests, in addition to hopefully moving Mubarak out eventually, will also have helped to germinate some more organization by youth that I think would have to find its way into some government. And it's that group that's really been lacking. I mean, most outside of the Muslim Brotherhood, the other established political parties are very old. It's been a long time that there's been any regular channel outside the ruling party or the Brotherhood for younger people to get actively involved in formal politics. And I think that some of the folks who helped to organize these demonstrations, there are these younger people, I think those people will have to also be active participants in the new government.
Can I add something there?
Oh, of course. Yes.
I think we should also remember that the Muslim Brotherhood ran, not formally, but basically ran in the 2005 elections, which were fairly open, somewhat because of international pressure as well and domestic pressure. But they got about 19% of the vote, of the seats in parliament. So that was a kind of a political liberalization. So they've had experience with elections. They ran elections well. At the same time, in 2010, one of the instigating catalysts for this uprising, also we should remember, is we just had parliamentary elections, and they were the most rigged and the most exclusionary in Egyptian history since about 1973. So there were very, very few people, very few members of opposition parties that got seats, and there were other opposition parties that pulled out of the process because they found it so gerrymandered. So just like in the United States, there's many differences of opinion. We have a huge evangelical movement. We have many people in this country who have created sort of the Christian right. And so a democracy has differences of opinion, and we can't sort of, if we're really interested in democracy and what these people are claiming, what they want are just basic citizenship rights. They want basic rule of law. They want the end of military law. They want the right to participate. It's really very, very fundamental rights of citizenship that cross ideological lines. That's why it's really wrong to sort of suggest that one movement is behind this. This is a very broad, sweeping, national. That's also really unusual that you have massive protests, 2 million in Tahrir Square, but supposedly 8 million across the country.
Oh,
and
my.
We haven't seen that kind of mobilization all across Egypt since 1952, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing, isn't it, that you have this small group of young political organizers who put a call on the internet, 90,000 people sign up, and then you get 100,000 people at the first demonstration. That says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't think it's just youth, though. I actually write a lot on youth, and yes, they're completely involved. But it's also important that the youth have been really, really active in virtual politics, because even the bloggers were very depressed recently about the elections, and it didn't seem like something was happening. But they've been able to mobilize, and they've been able to sort of voice their concerns and network, and then as soon as there's a crack, as soon as there's a political opportunity, they start organizing on the ground. And coming into the Tahrir Square and other places are people from the labor unions, people from the Muslim Brotherhood, people from the women's movement, all kinds of people. So yes, it's the young people, and yes, the majority of Egyptians are young, and they have particular concerns because they've been disproportionately economically affected by economic policies lately. But it's also a really broad section. But the virtual world has been really, really important, obviously.
Vicky, in a recent piece in Foreign Policy that you wrote, you say these are the words of Condoleezza Rice: for 60 years, the U.S. pursued stability at the expense of democracy in the Middle East, and we achieved neither. Now we're taking a different course. We're supporting the democratic aspirations of all people. This is Condoleezza Rice in Cairo in 2005. Which is the fairly recent past. What happened to that embracing of democracy? What's happened since the Obama administration took over? What are they worried about?
Well, I think that was in, as you say, in 2005, and then in November 2005, the elections that Diane referred to, had the Muslim Brothers received 19-20% of the vote. They were by far the biggest group, opposition, formal kind of opposition group in the parliament. They had many, many more representatives than all the rest of the opposition combined, although only 20% total, which is important to remember. It was not anywhere near 40 or 50% or something. And that was not an outcome that the Bush administration had hoped for. Some people have even speculated that the regime kind of manipulated those results, letting the Brotherhood win as many as they did, given that they rigged those elections as well. They weren't perfectly free and fair, if only to send a message to the Bush regime that this is what happens when you get free elections. We don't know if that's the case, but I do think that they were taken aback by that, and that cooled their ardor for democracy somewhat. But then most clearly, the fact that Hamas won in free and fair elections in the Palestinian territories in January of 2006, I think, was kind of the death knell of any support from the Bush administration for democracy.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Obama administration, Diane?
It's a really interesting question. There were so many expectations after his speech in Cairo,
mm-hmm,
that the Obama administration would have a bit of a more equitable and a more sort of committed to some kind of transition. I think what happened to the Obama administration is two things. Obviously, the economic crisis received his attention, and that was necessary. But the other thing is that they tried to move forward with the peace process. And one of the things that President Mubarak has done so skillfully is to play the role of an intermediary in the region and in the world for the United States. So he can say to the United States, back off, don't get involved, don't intervene domestically, don't tell me what to do, because I'm going to be useful to you in the peace process. Now, we haven't seen any fruits from the peace process. Basically, the Prime Minister of Israel was able to outmaneuver the Obama administration, and that seems to be going nowhere. And he's lost a lot of credibility at the same time. And so I think in the Arab world, in the Middle East, in the Muslim world, there's great disappointment with President Obama. There's hopes. But in fact, it's very ironic that because of the Bush administration policy in the Middle East, they were able to to pressure Egypt in 2005, and that led to some important changes. And so everyone is expecting and hoping the Obama administration, obviously, it's quite hypocritical to come out on January 25th and start talking about democracy in Egypt. I two things I would hope the Obama administration would do. One thing that they can really do is to put tremendous pressure, along with global companies, to restore the internet, because that is creating difficulty in Egypt. All of these demonstrations are going on in population centers, and so that's important just for the way that people to negotiate their way in this situation, and also for people to be able to communicate and organize. And that's an amazing step. I mean, I'm not sure where else in the world a president has shut down the internet for the entire country. I know it happened in China in 2008 for one region where there was unrest. And that suggests that President Mubarak, again, is willing to do whatever it takes.
Right.
And the internet is absolutely essential to Egypt's economic policy to position itself as the tiger on the Nile and a force in the global economy. And for him to do that suggests sort of almost how desperate he is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the administration really has to focus on that. And the administration, as Vicky Langer said, the administration needs to speak with the opposition. It needs to calm down these fears and stop talking about stability and chaos.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to stop talking about chaos, because actually the protesters have been tremendously disciplined. There has not been a lot of violence, and that narrative of stability and chaos, if you don't have stability, almost by default you have chaos, and that diminishes and sort of dehumanizes. It causes people to use these kinds of huge categories like the Arab street. And we need to learn more about the diversity of Egyptian politics. We need to recognize and acknowledge that, and stop speaking in these huge in these narratives that almost create fear. And finally, this narrative of chaos, it legitimizes Mubarak. Like, we need Mubarak to keep a lid on the Middle East, and that's really offensive. It's almost racist for people from the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're always playing catch up. Why is it that Mubarak is holding on so long, and why don't the protesters, this may be simplistic, but isn't there a way to sort of go to the parliament and demand, you know, a citizen's arrest of the guy? Vicky?
I would assume that he is being pretty well guarded. There's certainly been a lot of question, for example, about where his son Gamal Mubarak is, but I would assume that it's probably physically impossible to reach him. I mean, one thing that could happen and is already happening in some ways is, of course, you've had another huge demonstration today, calls for a general strike. I mean, already, just because of the conditions in the country, increasing lack of fuel, as Diane said, lack of ability not just to coordinate protests, but just basic work shutdowns because companies can't, you know, order supplies, things like this, because of lack of internet, can't use credit cards because of lack of internet. So the economy, both because of the protesters, you know, not allowing things to go on as normal, but also because of Mubarak's own steps, is kind of shutting down. So in some ways, that may be the way that it happens. Not so much that I don't think they are physically able to kind of do anything to the person of Mubarak, nor should they be violent, nor, as Diane pointed out, do they want to be. That's not their intent
right.
at all. But it does seem that, kind of by definition, even just basic daily life as normal is not able to function anymore, not to mention, obviously, political life. So I think that is more the direction things are going. Can I just say one more thing about the Obama administration should do, though? Is that okay?
Of course.
I've been encouraged, on the one hand, by a couple of things I've heard, but I think it's time to move further. I was encouraged, for example, on Friday when Press Secretary Robert Gibbs had a couple of questions from press people about, isn't the Muslim Brotherhood behind this? Couldn't the Muslim Brotherhood take over? And he really shot those down pretty effectively and said, these are the demands of the Egyptian middle class. This is not a monolithic group of people putting forward their agenda. And that's exactly right. And I was happy to hear that a move away from that narrative that the Brotherhood has to be behind everything and that would have to be the ones to take advantage of it. And at that time on Friday, he spoke pretty clearly about reviewing the American aid package, which it seems that Hillary Clinton has stepped back a little bit from. But that was also exactly the direction that things need to go in. And on Sunday on the talk shows, you heard Hillary Clinton repeatedly using the word transition. And Diane and I are both political scientists. Transition for us very clearly means the end of a regime. I'm not sure that that's what she meant, but it seems to me that that's a pretty strong word. But on the other hand, I think the Obama administration really has to signal there's a time period in which these changes have to be done, that the American willingness to just keep calling for unspecified reforms is not going to go on indefinitely. I just saw again today on BBC that El-Baradei is calling for Mubarak to step down by Friday, and if in fact the U.S. is intensifying its contacts with them, I think there needs to be a very clear set of reforms that Mubarak is asked to do by the U.S., and then when, as I would predict, he doesn't do them, that's the clear end, at the point at which the U.S. very clearly says we no longer support this regime, or kind of a time deadline. But it's real. We're running out the clock is not helping the U.S. in any way. There's a lot of nice words, but how long is this supposed to go on for?
We have many people who would like to speak with both of you, and we'll start taking phone calls momentarily. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about Egypt this hour of the program, and our guests are Vicki Langer, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the College of the Holy Cross, Professor Diane Singerman in the Department of Government, School of Public Affairs, and co-director of Middle East Studies at American University are our guests this hour. We also want to remind you that in addition to a major blizzard, which is to take place today in much of southeastern Wisconsin, to the State of the Union address, State of the State address, is taking place tonight at 7 here on the Ideas Network, live from the state capitol. We will be bringing you Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's State of the State address, followed by a response from Democratic State Senator Peter Barca. Frederica Freiberg and Sean Johnson will be joining you, WPR special tonight. The State of the State address at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, former U.S. Senator Adlai Stevenson will be with us. He's written a really interesting book. His grandfather, who was vice president of the country, his father, who was governor of Illinois and presidential candidate twice in 52 and 56, and Senator Adlai Stevenson himself, who had a number of public service positions, will be joining us. He's put together a black book, and all of these gentlemen kept little pieces of paper and wrote in notebooks quotations they wanted to remember, thoughts about the United Nations, about war, about peace and humor. Actually, the family history and politics goes way back to his grandfather, great-grandfather it would have been, who helped to get Abraham Lincoln the Republican nomination. So it will be great. It will be very interesting. That's our number two, Adlai Stevenson. All right, let's go to phone calls, starting with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I think it's very important for people to network the concept that on a bipartisan basis for many, many years, we have supported regimes throughout the world that have repressed people, especially people of color. And in Egypt, for example, a majority of our money goes to the military, and the military supports the police who have been involved in abducting, torturing, raping, sodomizing, and murdering people. And the tear gas containers that are fired at the people during the demonstrations, of course, have Made in America labeled on them, and the people note this. And to follow this further in the net, people should look at Google Egypt torture. And above all, please listen carefully to this. Google Torture Comes to America, which documents over the years many, many different regimes that we have supported, in some cases trained, that have been engaged in torture. And it was interesting to me that even one quote even went back to Greece in the late 1940s, where they said they engaged in the torture because they knew that the United States government was behind it. So please encourage people to network. Torture comes to America, and spread the word.
Thank you, Jim, for the call. Diane, you want to start?
Sure. Very interesting points, important points, and Jim raises two things. The importance of the military. And my colleague, Professor Eva Bellin at Brandeis University, writes a lot about the ways in which U.S. aid and other kinds of foreign aid have been used by the Mubarak regime, $1.3 billion a year for the last few years, basically to support the security apparatus, basically to, in other words, Mubarak does not need to rely on his own domestic resources because he has this pot of money for training, for weapons. And so, in a sense, economic aid has only recently been about $200 million, $250 million, but security aid has been much more. And we're not sure what the military is up to. We're really not. It's very hard to know. People are making a big distinction between the military and the regime. I'm not so sure the military is very hard. It could still be completely behind Mubarak, and or it could be sort of trying to figure out who it's behind, and there could be junior officers in the military or a younger cohort. The military was apparently quite upset that Gamal Mubarak, the president's son, was to be the successor, because power has been from the military, vested in the military. Omar Suleiman is from the military. The prime minister is from the military for a very long time. And so Gamal Mubarak coming to power was going to be a problem. The second thing that the caller said, very important. One of the really kind of catalysts of all this is also an online movement called We Are All Khalid Sayed. And Khalid Sayed was a young man in Alexandria who was kicked to death, I believe, by police when he was sitting in an internet cafe.
Mm.
And so since that time, there's been, again, a virtual movement of objecting to torture. The bloggers have also done things like, for the first time, filmed torture in Egyptian prisons and publicized it. And when other people have been killed by the police, those people are called sort of Khalid Sayeds as well. And so, yes, people are very upset about torture, and under military law, emergency law has been in place since Sadat was assassinated. And that has always been the focus of civil society, to restore basic political rights, because emergency law gives the state tremendous repressive power.
Vicki, I want to talk about transition for a moment with you. In the eyes of the Egyptian people, and if it's a different answer, in the eyes of the United States as well, in terms of foreign policy and our role in Egypt, but let's start with the Egyptian people. When you're looking at a transition, do you have some kind of idea in mind of what would be best for Egypt? Do the people who are protesting have an idea of what they want right now?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that what would be best for Egypt is what Egyptians want. I mean, it's not for Americans to say what would be best, but it seems to me that what people want is obviously Mubarak to step down immediately. I think it's beyond the point that, as far as what the people want, that they're interested in any kind of solution that keeps him in power, or not just him, but also this Omar Suleiman, his vice president, or anyone around him. So I think that's pretty clear. But then I think what people want is a transition relatively quickly to free and fair elections. And that, I think, would happen, I would presume, within the next few months if Mubarak were to step down. You've probably seen that a committee of about 10 people has been authorized, headed by El-Baradei, but including other people like Ayman Nour, who was the person who was allowed to run against Mubarak in 2005 for the presidential elections and then was summarily put in prison for several years on trumped-up charges, to send a sign that you couldn't actually hope to get away with challenging Mubarak. So this committee has already been formed and has been, as much as we can tell, given the right by the people who are actively involved in organizing the protests to negotiate, hopefully first, obviously, a step down of Mubarak, but then some kind of relatively quick transition to free and fair elections. And so at that point, obviously, the Egyptian people will decide what would be the best thing going forward.
Yeah. And obviously people in Washington are thinking about what would be the best thing for U.S. interests in that part of the world, because we do tend to act that way. Will our interests coincide with what you just described?
Well, I think the first thing to do would be to question what are our interests. I mean, our interests, for example, the main interest that we always hear about is an interest of Egypt not breaking the Camp David Accords, and then as Diane had spoken about President Mubarak in the past having participated in various negotiations, ceasefires with Hamas and Israel, bringing various factions in Palestine to the table. I don't think that any future government would involve itself in any kind of adventurism with Israel. But I think beyond that, most of the foreign policy program of the United States with regard to Israel-Palestine has not been successful. And you don't have to be kind of a leftist to see that. As Diane pointed out, there haven't been peace talks for a long time. When they exist, they die almost immediately. The release of these Palestine papers last week makes clear what has been clear actually for a long time, that the Palestinians have been bending over backwards to offer concessions, and they have not been met by the Israelis. The Israelis continue with settlement building apace. So the question of what the position of a future government towards Israel would be, I would feel pretty confident in saying that they would not be involved in any kind of war-making with Israel, if only because, at least because, the government would be very focused on getting itself in order and getting Egypt in order, and they wouldn't want to be involved in foreign adventurism with Israel. But in terms of other positions that Egypt would take on Israel, that would again be up to that government. But I think the problem with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a problem that really has very little to do with Egypt, and Egypt doesn't play a big role in that as far as I'm concerned.
Let's go to Hugh from Milwaukee next. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. I think that we're taking the wrong policy. I think we should support Mubarak in his efforts to press down these Islamic extremists, even al-Baradei. I mean, he was a UN guy in, looking at Iranian nuclear fission, and basically gave them a pass. You talk about torture in Egypt under Mubarak. Well, what about Iran, where you can stone women to death and when you can kill people very easily? That's not called torture. No, that's called religious law.
But what and is any
let me just say something that I think our policy is totally wrong under Barack Obama, and we should support Mubarak. And there should be a Tiananmen situation where you get notice, by the way, that the suicide bombers are not in the squares now, because they support the protests, they support the overthrow of the government. They can use their suicide bombers to destroy churches. They can use their suicide bombers all over the world. But Mubarak is against the suicide bomber crowd, and he should crack down on the extreme Muslims.
All right, Hugh, thanks for the call. Diane.
Well, the suicide bombers, too. The main political issue of the last couple of weeks has been a totally cross-class movement of all Egyptians, Muslim and Christian, to totally reject the suicide bombing in the church. And there's no reason whatsoever to believe that Egypt would become like Iran. That's a completely bogus connection as far as I'm concerned.
It's also the question is some of the comparison. There has been a huge democracy movement in Iran, as the caller, I'm sure, is aware. And so there are many, many Iranians who are objecting to their lack of participation in the government. I think the sort of bogeyman of Islamist extremists is, again, something that we have to be careful about. You know, so many people who study this region from across the spectrum, so many of us sort of want to recognize that people have opinions about things. And if the caller believes in dictatorship, that's fine. If the sort of implications of what he's saying is that we need to limit and constrain political participation, and basically Muslim people should not have political rights. Muslim people aren't really citizens because they're all going to attack the West. And it's just too simplistic, and there are people who are on the fringe who are interested in violence, but what people would say about Egypt is that state violence has also created the violence, that excluding people, not allowing people to do very kind of everyday politics has actually almost created the violence. And it's interesting because in Egypt itself, many within the Islamist movement actually, while they were in prison a few years ago, made a pact that they had taken a wrong path, that violence was not the answer. And what's interesting that we know about from Morocco, from Turkey, is that the Islamists and the Muslim Brotherhood, who are very much in the middle, actually have been affected so much by the harassment, by the torture, by the imprisonment, that they, in the process, have become more committed to democracy, just as so many people in Iran have become more committed to democracy. They're not able to express that. They're not able to win the battle in Iran, but they've become so committed to a basic ability to check power and the accountability. And that's a really interesting phenomenon, I think, in the Middle East.
And we are going to pause for just a moment. Vicky, I know you have to teach a class, so we want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I hope we can call on you again as these developments unfold in Egypt. Vicky Langer leaving us. Diane is staying with us. Vicky is associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the College of the Holy Cross. We're talking about Egypt this hour of the program and welcoming your phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network from the state capitol, we'll be bringing you Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's State of the State Address, followed by a response from Democratic State Senator Peter Barca. Your hosts are Frederica Freiberg and Sean Johnson. Tonight, 7 o'clock, Governor Scott Walker's State of the State Address, and that is here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, former Senator, U.S. Senator Adlai Stevenson will be joining us. He has put together the Black Book, well, he has, and his father and his great-grandfather. It's American Politics and History as Experienced by Five Generations of the Stevenson Family. So he'll be with us to talk about war and peace and legislation in the 70s, the environment, his father, his grandfather, Abraham Lincoln. It's an extraordinarily rich history, and so we'll be speaking with him about that, hour number two. Back to phone calls. Egypt is what we're discussing this hour. Ray in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Ray.
Kathleen, I just have a little criticism. When we have a very important subject like this or what happened in Arizona, could you spend the whole hour focused on this subject? We've heard about what's coming up next hour like four times already. Now, I want to get to my question. Robert Gibbs yesterday said it's not up to us to decide when Mubarak will go. Robert Gibbs should have mentioned in his statement that for the last 2 years, he and Mr. Obama and these cronies in our government, who I voted for, by the way, have decided to stand up with a dictator and send him $1.3 billion a year for the last 2 years. So we have been the reason that he has been able to stay there. And for our government to stand up with a dictator against its own people would be similar to during the civil rights movement. Mr. Obama said, well, Jesse Helms, you know, you can stay in power in your state. We don't want to see any changes from the Jesse Helms or the George Wallaces. And let the civil rights movement just take its own course. We're not going to choose sides. I am so outraged by what our government is doing on this subject. I want to move to Canada now.
Diane.
Well, I appreciate your comments and obviously share your concerns. Actually, the foreign economic and military aid is larger than $1.3 billion, and it's been in place since 1979, approximately $60 billion since then. But I want to say another thing in that at the same, unfortunately, to pursue national interests, this is not a new history in the United States. It's unfortunate that we have been on the side of other problematic political leaders time and time again. I think that part of the problem is that in the United States, there is not as much of citizens like Ray who actually care about the aspirations of a large percentage of the Middle East. And our focus has been on oil and Israel. And yes, there's great contradictions. But at the same time, I don't want to completely forget that the administration has, in an earlier incarnation, put into place the human rights agenda, fostering civil society organizations. And I think President Obama, also because of the sort of continuity between administrations in the Middle East agenda with Secretary of State Clinton, has focused on Israel, and they've put all their cards on the peace process, and it hasn't worked. So, yes, the United States is in a very delicate position, and I share your concerns. I share your criticism. Many people have been criticizing the government. That's in the past. We can't really do anything about that. And I would also say that we cannot, at the same time, dictate to President Mubarak. I mean, President Mubarak has played a very shrewd role in playing off the United States from other actors, in taking assistance, but also promoting what he thought were Egyptian national interests. So he is not our pawn. He is not our puppet. And at the same time that we have to sort of understand the democratic aspirations of Egypt, we also have to understand it's not just President Mubarak, it's the National Democratic Party, it's an economic elite that has benefited. So there is, I think we don't need like a strong man theory of leadership. We need to look at the Egyptian state. And some of this is also a consequence of our free market policy, our neoliberal policies, but we've been promoting, since the Clinton administration, free markets, but without freedoms. And now we need to work more on the freedoms. And that also is going to make a more dynamic and a more equitable and a more accountable economy as well.
Here's an email from Karen in Madison. What is the status of women in Egypt under the Mubarak regime, and do you think their rights and treatment will improve or worsen in a successor government?
Well, that's an interesting question. I write on gender issues in the Middle East as well. I'm teaching a course on that in a few minutes, but it's interesting. There's a vibrant women's movement in Egypt. There's vibrant feminist groups in Egypt. Actually, in the last elections, there is a much larger quota for women in Egypt. And so on the one hand, there's a term that sometimes we use to talk about the situation. We talk about state feminism. And since 1952, in some sense, the government decided also that it needed women in the economy. It needed women to be educated. And so this whole developmental agenda of promoting women's rights, but without democratic rights, so that the state, in some sense, promoted education for women and promoted women working in the public sector. What's happened more recently is that the women's movement itself is more diversified. There are Islamist feminists. There's lots of women, or there are women certainly active in the Muslim Brotherhood and across the labor movement. There's a lot of women active in the labor movement. There's a tremendous number of professional women. There has been this discourse on the web that you don't see women in the streets. That's because there's a lot of violence. I imagine today you see a lot more protesters. On January 25th, you see a lot more protesters. But even the women's movement, they're in this position, like, do they try to get their agenda across by negotiating with, by asking the government and the first lady always to be their patron? Do you have to go through the state to get what you want? And the women's movement, lots of activists, it's diversified. There's lots of women who are active in the political parties, in the leftist movement, in the labor movement, but they also are calling for citizenship rights. They also want to be able to organize and hold meetings and have their NGOs and not get harassed by the government.
Saeed is next from Green Bay. Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think there are many lessons of the 1979 revolution in Iran that are very applicable here that we must keep track of. First, your guest's discussion of the Islamist, the Muslim Brotherhood, reminds me of the academics of the day in 1979 that predicted Khomeini would usher in an era of democracy in Iran. I think they are underestimating that potential threat. But the important thing is to remember the Spring of Freedom. The Spring of Freedom was the spring of 1979 when the people in Iran were jubilant with their displacement of the Shah. And a wide spectrum of political operatives representing the full of Iranian society were vying for political power. And if you fast forward from there to a year from there, the Islamists, the Khomeinists, had full control and have retained full control to the detriment of Iranian society. I think we should remember that Spring of Freedom and understand the ascension of that element to power and take safeguards here to make sure that doesn't happen. One of the safeguards, and it's a very critical in my judgment, is the survival of the integrity and the legitimacy of the military institution as a guarantor of the will of the people. The military should aspire, and we have extensive connections with the Egyptian military. Their senior leadership has been trained in the United States, and through military aid, we have very extensive connections with them. I think we should be advising them that if they are used to maintain order in the streets, and that results in lots of people getting killed, the military will lose its legitimacy and will not be able to be the guarantor of a safe process afterwards, of which the Islamists will exploit extensively.
Professor Singerman.
Yeah, you raise some really important points, and whenever political science study transitions and revolutions, the Iranian revolution comes up. And so I want to respond to a couple of things. I understand your concern that academics aren't understanding the real instrumentality of the Muslim Brothers, and they're just waiting, and then they're going to use coercion. But I'd like to point out a couple of differences. First of all, we have no Khomeini. We have no central, charismatic, legitimate, long-standing activist that can play that role. Secondly, as in the Iranian Revolution, there is a cross-section of people interested in this transition. But what we don't see is the ideological message that the revolutionaries in Iran and Khomeini and a sort of a Shia narrative of oppression, we don't see that at this point in time. My colleague Asif Bayat talks about how in Iran, there was a political revolution without a social revolution. In Egypt, there's more of a social movement where people have become more conservative, more religious. There's many kind of manifestations of religion. But the Muslim Brotherhood is one organization. There's other organizations. Third, I think this is different in the sense that in the Iranian Revolution, there was tremendous worry, resentment against the United States, against the West, and we see that a little bit. But in the Egyptian case, you know, you don't step in the same river twice. And in the Egyptian case, activists have always been concerned about the Palestinian issue, about all kinds of things. But in about 2005, there was this switch where they were sort of, let's worry about our own government. It's about our own government. It's about our own rule of law. So I think the fact that today in the streets, we don't see people attacking the U.S. Embassy. The U.S. Embassy is about a half a block from Tahrir Square, right? We don't see demonstrations at the Israeli embassy. And so we don't have that same kind of discourse, which means that perhaps the transition is also not going to demand this radical rupture with the West. I mean, economic interest, foreign investment, foreign companies, European companies, Turkish companies are all quite involved in the Egyptian economy. But the caller raises a really important point about the military, but I would disagree with him. So many people, including Dr. Al-Baradi and the Muslim Brothers, they are tired of military rule. They do not want the military. It's time for a civilian government. But the caller is quite right. We do not want, for different reasons, we should remember the Iraqi example where the United States made a huge mistake by dismantling the army, by dismantling the police. And the military should stay in power, as the caller says, as a guarantor. And that's what the military is saying. They want to protect public order, public buildings, private property. And that role is really important, but I would not give the military the same kind of legitimacy as the caller might, that this is the only national institution. That's the problem. This has been the only national institution. So in Turkey, we're seeing this renegotiating of balance of power between the army, which supports and defends a secular state, and the AK Party, the Justice and Development Party.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Thank you so much for all of your insight. I hope you'll join us again, Professor.
Thank you. I'm sorry to go on.
No, it's fine. We learned a lot. Professor Diane Singerman, Associate Professor, Department of Government, School of Public Affairs, Co-Director of Middle East Studies, and author of Cairo Contested, Governance, Urban Space, and Global Modernity. That's just one of the books that she has written. Thanks to Rhonda Fanny and Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy for on-air production. We'll return